Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Tuesday morning, and thanks for listening to the show on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later on this hour, research is advancing on whether marijuana can help people who are suffering with PTSD, and why is the hole in the Earth's ozone layer smaller?
But first, more than 107,000 people moved to Arizona between July 1st of 2016 and July 1st of this year. That translates to a 1.6% increase and ranks the state in the top 10 in both numeric and percentage increases over the past year. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. With me to talk about what that all means is Tom Rex with the Center for Competitiveness and Prosperity Research at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. And Tom, how significant or not significant do you think these numbers are for the state?
Depends on perspective, I suppose. If you're really interested in just comparing ourselves to the other states, we're literally always in the top 10. The only exception was during the last recession, and we used to run number two almost every single year, number two behind Nevada. So we're actually down from where we were in terms of the rank, and we used to be far, far above most all the states, along with Nevada and a couple of other Sun Belt states. The difference now is much, much less. So, yes, we're above average, but not by all that much.
Well, especially for a state, as you say, that has relied on growth so much for its economic well-being, are these numbers, frankly, good enough to get Arizona to where it wants to be?
Well, you really don't need to grow fast to do well economically. The growth rate itself has no relationship whatsoever to prosperity, which is what I think everyone is most interested in. So we don't need to grow fast to do that. And in fact, we've been doing a very poor job of prosperity growth despite our rapid growth. On the other hand, there is some adjustment to be made if you're used to growing very, very fast to not growing so fast. But, I mean, the growth rate now is certainly moderate. You know, we had a real struggle there for a few years during the recession, and things have picked back up. We're not growing anywhere near as fast as we used to, but it's still a, you know, a reasonable rate of growth. So I would say we're in actually pretty good territory right now, not growing so fast as to cause problems, but growing fast enough to make sure everyone's getting jobs. And our unemployment right now is almost down to full employment.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, when you have so many people coming in a short period of time, I would imagine that puts all kinds of strains on all kinds of levels of government and services. Is this in some ways a more manageable and sustainable rate of growth for Arizona?
Certainly more manageable, yes, because you're right. During the prior economic expansions, when we saw really rapid growth, it was a real struggle for the municipalities, for the utilities and the like to keep up with that growth. So it is, in that regard, much, much more comfortable than what it was.
Does Arizona's ranking, in the sense that it's not in the top two or three anymore, does that indicate that, especially going forward, maybe there will be more competition for people to move to other states, whereas in the past Arizona was, you know, one of the top couple destinations?
I don't think it's so much a matter of competition as what's happened since the last recession is nobody is growing all that fast. And a good part of that, most of that probably, is Americans simply are not moving as much as they did moving long distances. In addition, we're not getting the flows of immigration that we had, particularly the undocumented. So in Arizona, that's where our growth has come from. It's from people moving here from other states and from immigrants. And that's down, but it's not just down in Arizona. It's down throughout the Sun Belt. So you just got this real narrowing they're just, it's much more even across the country now than what it was.
Are there things that the census numbers can and cannot tell us about the state of the economy in Arizona and sort of the, just sort of the state of demographics in this state?
Well, yes. I mean, the estimates are not detailed at all. You know, they'll get into a little detail later regarding age and race ethnicity, but it really doesn't tell you very much about the nature of the people.
Well, so I guess given what these census numbers tell us, what will you be looking for? Like, what's the next piece of information that you would like to see to really get a sense of maybe what these numbers actually mean and what they might mean going forward?
Well, I mean, you almost have that already, in that for those people who are not retired, for them to make a long-distance move, they have to have a job. And so really the job growth leads the population growth for the bulk of the population. So, you know, we've got numbers on employment, and we have, you know, we have a rate of growth now that slowed a little from the peak a year or two ago, but really it's been pretty consistent over the last 6 years or so. So that's more your leading indicator than the other way around. Is if you see employment growth either slow or pick up, then you can pretty safely predict that population growth is doing the same thing with just a slight lag.
All right. That's Tom Rex with the Center for Competitiveness and Prosperity Research at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a regular segment where we talk about the big issues facing the state and the region, featured in the newspaper's viewpoints section. The newspaper has announced its Arizonans of the Year, Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake. And with me to talk about why they were selected is Phil Boas, director of the Republic's editorial department. Phil, was the choice ever in doubt for you and the editorial board?
Kind of a no-brainer this year because these two men were very much a part of a national conversation. In fact, the focal point of national conversations during the year. Flake, when he wrote his book and also when he gave a speech, that was pretty important. And then McCain, when he made his historic return to the Senate. So this was easy, though it didn't require much thought to figure it out.
Is there one thing from each of those you'd want to pinpoint in terms of the impact they had this year?
Well, I think with McCain, the fact that he had this catastrophic diagnosis, you know, that he was almost certainly going to die because of this cancer, this very aggressive form cancer that he has, and then to come back to the Senate and almost in a serene and forceful way to call on the members of that deliberative body to begin to live up to their birthright in this country, to be able to stand for values that matter and have mattered over centuries in America, and to remember who they are. And it was really a powerful speech and one that will be remembered a long, long time. And for Jeff Flake, I mean, Jeff Flake didn't begin this with a speech this year. This began last year with Donald Trump, where he was willing to stand up and tell the Republican Party that this guy was unworthy in many ways. Flake tweeted out on Christmas Day, he'd gotten a mug that says, "Decency wins." Well, decency hasn't won. Decency is in retreat, and Flake was one of the guys to stand up for it, but it's going to have to be fought for.
Now, those two as individuals, I would think even those who disagree with them politically understand exactly what you're saying, the impact that they've had this year and how they did step out in a sense that politicians usually don't do. Will their impact be felt in a broader sense? Will they actually inspire some sort of movement? In Flake's case, maybe just people treating each other better? Because a lot of people complimented them on it, and then it didn't seem like they got a lot of followers in that sense.
Yeah, it may take time to appreciate it, but before you can stand up for some of the ill winds in our culture, before you can defeat them, you first need courageous people to stand up and be the first ones to say, you know, this isn't right. We need to stop this. I think what is misunderstood a lot here, though, in what is going on in America, if there was a word for 2017, and the word was tribalism. And McCain used this word in his speech. He said that he cannot remember a time when we were this divided, this tribal. And so what Trump did was he started nursing the grudge of the white conservatives, you know, and he turned that into its own tribe and started working it. And I don't even think he could articulate it, but that's what he did and what he was doing. And the American people, we're a family. We're all here together. We're on the same continent. We got to work it out together. And if you look at a family, I can tell you that a family that isn't pulling together and helping each other and working together, that's an unhealthy family. And we need more leaders in this country. We were talking about this in our family dinner yesterday at Christmas. We need more leaders, young leaders in this country.
Well, in a simpler sense of the tribalism, coming back to the Arizonans of the Year in McCain and Flake, Flake is someone who has criticized the president strongly. And yet, of course, he's been criticized for then still voting along with the president. So do we have to look outside politics then? Because here's someone who clearly stands up for his principles, and yet politically, or at least on issues, he agrees with this person a lot. So do we have to look for someone who's not connected to a political party, for example?
I have this debate all the time, especially at the newspaper. We have this debate. You know, Flake stood up against Donald Trump and some of his worst impulses. Why does that mean that he's supposed to stop acting like a conservative Republican? And, you know, he goes and does that, and he's savage for doing it. And McCain, likewise, because he voted for tax reform, he was behaving like the creature that he is. McCain is a conservative Republican, and he voted like a conservative Republican. But he did a courageous thing, and the left needs to recognize that without savaging because he didn't remain their servant on the left. That's not what he was doing or what he's about. So.
Are political parties in some sense the enemy of this anti-tribalism you're talking about, this idea that people can come together? Because it is all about wins for these parties, it seems.
It is, and we're dividing and subdividing. We don't need leaders who can think in silos today. We need leaders who can think about all Americans, who care about the whole family and not just a segment or not their self-interested segment. They need to think about all of us. Find me those leaders. We need that in America.
Phil Boas is director of the Arizona Republic's editorial department.
It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein and the Takeaway's Todd Zwillick. We go now to California. It's been one of the worst fire seasons in that state's history. Residents in Southern California face an existential threat from the effects of the late season Thomas Fire in the mountains of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Meanwhile, back in October, California's wine country further north was scorched by fires, causing destruction of an estimated 9,000 structures.
These fires have meant staggering losses for residents, people who've lost their homes, in some cases, nearly all of their belongings. Ken Klein is a law professor at California Western School of Law and a legal expert on natural disasters. Ken explains what steps people need to take when they get down to the business of recovery.
Think about the things you have to do as you're going through the steps of trying to rebuild. The first thing you have to do is find a place to live. Then you start the process of just having stuff to live with. For example, I lost my home in the 2003 fires, and the first thing I bought the next day was a toothbrush because I didn't own one. So you have to acquire things to just bridge your life until you rebuild. Then you'll go through the entire process of making a buildable pad, potentially drawing plans, going through plan check, hiring contractors, all of that work. One of the coverages you have in your home insurance policy are all the expenses you're incurring to live elsewhere because you still owe your mortgage payment on top of now whatever rent you're going to pay if you can find a place to live. And all those expenses, such as that rent, are called alternative living expenses, or ALE. Most, not all, but most home insurance policies have a one-year time limit in which to spend that ALE, and you simply cannot rebuild in all likelihood within a year. So California law states that if the state declares an emergency, which all of these fires have been declared, that the period of time in which you're entitled to ALE cannot be less than 2 years.
So that means that people have a 2-year limit to still collect these benefits while they rebuild. Look, as you said, there are going to be thousands, tens of thousands of homes that need to be rebuilt. And people are going to have to wait in line for construction, for contractors, for professionals to get in there. Is 2 years going to work for a lot of people?
2 years is not going to work for a lot of people. For example, in the fire we had here in San Diego in 2003, my neighborhood lost 312 homes. That's 312 homes out of 12,000 homes. And 62% of us were rebuilt at the two-year anniversary. The problems, delays, challenges in Ventura and in Santa Rosa and in the county of Sonoma are enormously larger. I think there is a very high likelihood that they will be significantly below a 50% reoccupation rate at the two-year anniversary.
So, Ken, you talk about your own experience in 2003. You lost your home in the Cedar Fire near San Diego. Were you an expert in this type of law and in what it takes to rebuild in California before it became a reality for you?
Absolutely not. I was a working lawyer in a national law firm, and I thought I was a pretty smart guy who knew a good bit about insurance and law. And when my home burned down, I learned that I knew absolutely nothing. And over the course of the next year, I say I became an involuntary expert in all sorts of things. But I knew absolutely nothing when my home burned down.
And so you've been through this horrible experience yourself. What do people need to know out of the gate here? I mean, you've talked about the two-year limit. It's not going to be enough. That might be a policy issue in Sacramento. What about individuals? What do they need to be thinking about in these first few weeks of trying to rebuild their lives?
They're going to have to learn all sorts of things at a legal level, at a logistical level, at a system level, at an emotional level. They're going to have to become very careful record keepers. They're going to have to keep bins of receipts of their alternative living expenses. They need to keep journals or diaries of everyone they speak to and what was said. They're going to have to navigate a lot of conversations with people that are much more knowledgeable than they are and have legal implications, such as insurance adjusters and their bank or mortgage company. And then they're going to have this whole emotional landscape they're going to have to navigate. For example, not let the fire define who they are, but just understand that it's a bad thing that happened in their life. And then they're going to have to learn something that doesn't come naturally to them, which is to accept help. Many of us, most of us perhaps, are raised to be self-sufficient, to be people who give help and not accept help. And they're going to have to get past that and learn that at least for the period of time that they are surrounded by folks who genuinely want to offer them help and ask, is there anything I can do, to always say yes.
Was that a hard lesson for you to learn?
It was a brutally hard lesson for me to learn. And in fact, ultimately, I would have not learned it had my wife not been convincing to me that this was how we were going to get back and get back to our lives as they were before the fire, at least as close as we could get to that.
So that was in 2003, the fire that you and your family survived. It's 2017 now. How long did it take before you looked around and looked at your kitchen or your house or stood on the front lawn and thought, yeah, we're back to normal?
When I no longer think about the fire and no longer reach for something in a drawer, for instance, in a holiday season decoration that I only use annually, I don't realize that it was something that I had before the fire and no longer own. When I get to the point where I'm there, I'll let you know. It's been 14 years, not there yet.
Wow, and that just paints a picture, Ken, for what so many thousands of people in California are about to be going through. It must give you a lot to think about, having been through this yourself, knowing that so many people, through no choice of their own, are about to join a club that you're already part of.
I genuinely feel for these folks as I meet them. They're walking in, they're dazed, they're disoriented, and I really see myself looking in a mirror. And what I tell them oftentimes is, you get always at least two fires. You get your fire and the next one. Because if we get this exactly right, you'll be doing what I'm doing for the next group of people impacted by a fire.
Ken Klein, law professor at California Western School of Law. Ken, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway, and you're listening to the show.
The scientific effort to draw true conclusions on whether marijuana helps people suffering from PTSD has been a process full of obstacles. One of the leaders on the research front has been Dr. Sue Sisley, who was let go by the U of A in 2013 after she'd already begun her study. Recently, she'd been working with Johns Hopkins University, specifically on the impact smoking pot can have on veterans with PTSD. But last spring, that collaboration also ended. That hasn't stopped Sisley, currently the president of Scottsdale Research Institute and site principal investigator on the Cannabis Veterans Clinical Trial. She's working on getting a total of 76 U.S. military veterans who live in Arizona to be in the controlled clinical trial. At this point, 32 have enrolled. The study's been cleared by the FDA and is funded by a grant from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, and the research is being sponsored by the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And Dr. Sisley is with me to talk more about her study. Dr. Sisley, as I mentioned, you've run into some bumps before. How is this study progressing?
Fortunately, things have finally been moving forward, and it's great to finally have the study fully implemented. So this controlled trial that's actually approved by the FDA has been running in Phoenix for the last about year and a half, and so we're almost halfway through this three-year clinical trial. Finally, we've hurdled all of the regulatory obstacles, and we're, you know, officially underway now for over a year. Our lab is located out in North Phoenix, and we are, you know, administering federally legal cannabis to these study participants. So this is cannabis that we've purchased from the federal government through the monopoly that at the University of Mississippi, that they have a government-enforced monopoly for the only federally legal supply of cannabis for any controlled trials in the U.S.
How do you then get the 40-plus people? Because I presume Department of Veterans Affairs, for whatever reason, is not working with you on this?
Yeah, at this point, the VA has been reluctant to participate in any way with the study. So we're hopeful that they would at least share information about the study with veterans. We're not asking them to endorse this. We're just hoping that they wouldn't block these communications with them. But right now, they're not comfortable with that. So at this point, we've managed to, you know, we've already pre-screened or screened over 4,000 veteran inquiries that have come to Scottsdale Research Institute. And of those 4,000 plus inquiries, only 34 have made it through all the screening criteria to be enrolled. But we're hopeful, you know, there's over 600,000 veterans here in Arizona, and we're hopeful that we can identify more of these folks, even without the cooperation of the Phoenix VA hospital.
Can you take us behind the curtain a little bit, as much as you're comfortable with the 30-plus veterans who've done it? You mentioned protocol before and the 10 weeks. Can you give us some detail of what you're looking for and what they're expected to do as participants?
Right. Well, so the veterans that we're seeking, you know, have to have a diagnosis of PTSD or at least be confident that they have the symptoms that meet criteria. So basically, we're looking for veterans of all ages that have post-traumatic stress disorder, and they have to be willing to utilize smoked marijuana at home. So what happens is after they go through the entire screening and they go through these intro sessions where we actually administer cannabis to them in our laboratory, and we monitor them for 4 hours at a time to verify that they're safe to use this and they're not having any side effects or adverse events, then they're invited to take this cannabis study drug home with them each week and utilize it to target their PTSD symptoms. So we don't specify the dose. They're given enough that they could take up to 1.8 grams of cannabis each day, but most of the veterans we find aren't using that much. Many of these vets are reporting that they only need a very small amount in order to control their PTSD, to initiate sleep at night and suppress the nightmares and flashbacks. So what happens is then each week they're required to bring back their unused marijuana from the week. They're in vials for each day so that we can measure how much they actually needed each day, and then we issue them a new one-week supply. So it's pretty straightforward. It's basically a patient self-titration model where the patients use what they need each day. They adjust their dose as they deem is necessary, and then they stop. And then they do that for 3 straight weeks, and then there's an abstinence period where they're cut off study drug for 2 weeks. And then there's a second part of the protocol, a crossover part, where they are reassigned to a new strain of cannabis. So if they were on a high THC phenotype during stage two, they would be assigned a completely different phenotype of cannabis, maybe high CBD or a 1-to-1 ratio of THC to CBD. And then they again use that for 3 weeks at home in order to manage their PTSD symptoms. And the whole time we are documenting all of their reactions to the cannabis. We're capturing the effect on their sleep. We're capturing information about their blood work and, you know, biomarkers for inflammation. We're drawing blood to see if the cannabis is having any anti-inflammatory effect. And then hopefully if the data is compelling, the FDA will allow us to go to phase 3, which will be more like 1,000 veterans over 3 or 4 different sites around the U.S. instead of what we have now, which is this phase 2 trial is just 76 veterans and in one site.
When we started, I referred to the obstacles that you've run into. Why do you think it has been so difficult to get consistent collaboration from certain groups about this? Is there just this specter of marijuana, whether it's considered medical or not?
Yeah, I think that just the word cannabis, marijuana, is so politically radioactive that people tend to recoil, especially elected officials, when they hear it. And so we've struggled with the stigma around the word cannabis, even though we're conducting a federally legal study. I just want to emphasize, Steve, that our team, even though, you know, we've been forced to behave like activists over the last 7 years while our study was being stonewalled by the government, but we are not pro-cannabis. Our researchers are neutral on this issue, and we don't have any agenda here other than to collect the most objective and unassailable data possible. So our efforts are to try to collect objective data that eventually will be published in a peer-reviewed medical journal so that everybody will have access to the data. All of the data will be put into the public domain so that everyone can scrutinize this. And so that's our only, I don't have any idea what the results of this study will be because the study is triple blind. So everyone is blinded in the study. That's how we've eliminated any chance of human bias. We're not pro-cannabis. We're just pro-research.
Dr. Sue Sisley is president of Scottsdale Research Institute. We've been talking about her current study on cannabis and veterans who have PTSD.
This week, we're revisiting our series, Homeless in Plain Sight. In yesterday's story, we learned that at any given time in Maricopa County, about 6,000 people are homeless. Today, KJZZ's Annika Klein digs further into that number to ask, who are the homeless?
6,000. It's a big number. Easy to get lost in if you're just one in 6,000.
My street name is Ladybug.
Robin Elric is 47. She wears glasses, and her vision is waning. She has a dog named Peanut.
She is a Chihuahua and a Beagle mix.
And she used to work at a carnival.
I worked the goldfish game.
Kenny Smith is a veteran. He joined the Air Force in 1987.
And I got out, I think, in 92. And it was like, well, gee, Kenny, the civilian airplanes don't have bombs and missiles, so what are you going to do now?
He has a beard, freshly trimmed, and when he talks, it's expressively, with his hands. And Vivian Manning Jackson is a New Yorker. She's married.
My husband's here with me, too.
And she has disabilities.
I have fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis. Any job I apply for, I'm going to get fired.
These three people are part of an estimated 553,000 homeless in the U.S. right now, a population that's mostly single adults. It's 60% men, 40% black. Serious mental illness affects about a third. And it might be surprising to learn that most homeless are sheltered.
We're full every single night.
Christy Saraceno is with Central Arizona Shelter Services, or CAS, in Phoenix. Almost 500 men and women come through the doors each afternoon to sleep here at night.
our clients are getting ready to come in for the day. Many of them have been out in the community doing what they need to do to end their homelessness.
And many will end it. Soon, actually.
Most people only stay one night. People who come to the shelter program are out of here pretty quickly, within a couple of weeks.
She says just 10% of CAS clients use the majority of bed nights. These are the chronically homeless, people with long or frequent patterns of homelessness who also have a disability.
Yes, and we're seeing increases in our number of chronically homeless individuals as well.
And that's not including the number sleeping on the streets. That number is high. Unlike the short-term homeless, the chronically homeless sleep on the streets far more than in a shelter, making that group even harder to help if they aren't turning up at the door to ask for it.
Sometimes you have to set your pride aside and, you know, let people help you.
That's Vivian Manning Jackson again, who you heard earlier describing her disabilities.
Fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis.
She's been homeless for half a year.
Meanwhile, while I'm here, you know what I mean, I do what little bit of things I can do to show my appreciation.
Like making the rows of beds, tucking the sheets neatly into their corners, like she used to do at home.
I really miss being able to just go into my linen closet, pick out a sheet.
She was evicted for failing to pay rent when money got tight.
There's a lot of people in our country that live their lives on the brink of homelessness.
Amy Donnelly is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Central Florida. She researches homelessness and poverty and says the two conditions are closer than you might think.
They're one emergency, one illness, one broken card from becoming homeless.
So for the 500,000 homeless out there, there are millions more in poverty who are on the threshold of losing their housing. In 2012, the Morrison Institute at ASU surveyed homeless in Arizona and found close to half said they lost their living space because they lost a job.
Being homeless is just a condition that people experience. It doesn't define someone.
Manning Jackson hopes soon it'll be a part of her life left in the past. She's waiting on Social Security benefits to kick in and thinks she might get approved for a place soon.
And I want it, you know, running my own household, you know, cooking my own meals, you know.
And then that's it. She won't be homeless anymore. Annika Klein, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can hear more stories at homeless.kjzz.org.
The hole in Earth's ozone layer this year was the smallest it's been in almost 30 years. Each September, scientists measure the hole over Antarctica. They say its reduced size this year was strongly impacted by, quote, an unstable and warmer Antarctic vortex, end quote. With me to explain is Kevin Gurney, a professor in the School of Life Sciences at ASU. He studies the global carbon cycle and climate change. And Kevin, what do you make of this news from NASA that the hole in the ozone layer has gotten smaller?
Yeah, I mean, it's good news. It's part of a long-term trend that we've seen about in the last decade, mostly driven by policy that was enacted in the late 80s and continued to accumulate through the 90s. But there's also, on top of that, we've had a couple of unusually warm years in Antarctica, in the upper atmosphere, which is the most acute area where ozone depletion occurs.
Yeah, it seems as though NASA had given a lot of the attribution to what it was calling an unstable and warmer Antarctic vortex. How much credit, I guess, should that weather pattern actually get?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tease them apart, but what I would say is sort of like it's an analogy to climate change and weather, right? We may have a long-term trend of the planet getting warmer, but in any given year, in a particular place, you can have more snow, it can be colder. And that's similar to what's going on in ozone depletion at the South Pole. There's a long-term trend that has been clear for the last decade or so of every single year the hole getting a little less severe. And then in the last couple of years, it just got unusually small, sort of beyond what we expected from that long-term trend because of this warming. But both are occurring, and I think in many ways it's important to understand both so that we get a good feel for where we're at in terms of this long-term effort to repair ozone levels in the atmosphere.
So is it something that we on Earth are doing that is contributing to at least some degree of this hole getting smaller?
Yeah, this is policy that was begun in the 1980s through an international cooperation, very similar to what we see these days with the climate change treaty. And so I think what we're seeing now is that the results of that effort.
Is it possible, do you think, to link what we're seeing as far as the hole in the ozone layer getting a little smaller to maybe other aspects of climate change in the sense that we can do things to maybe reverse some of what has been happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think, though, I, to be fair, climate change is a bigger problem. It has larger dimensions. It's a little harder to tackle just because at its core is the energy system of the planet. At the core of the ozone depletion problem was a somewhat narrower piece of industrial production. So that made it a little bit easier. However, I think it does demonstrate what can happen when countries get together, they recognize a problem, they make a concerted effort to do something about it, they can succeed. And I think the climate change treaty was fundamentally modeled after the ozone depletion treaty, but it looked to the ozone depletion treaty as, hey, that was an example of a success and an example of, you know, how we might go about doing this admittedly harder problem. But I think it's always been, to me and I think to all of us that look at the linkage between the policy and what we see in the atmosphere, it's always been an example of a success that we should use and model new treaties after because of how effective it was, recognizing that climate change has, you know, its own peculiar challenges because of its scope and size.
Do you think it's possible that at some point the ozone layer could be made whole again, that the hole could just entirely go away?
Yeah, I mean, the NASA's done projections that if everything goes as it has been and according to the plan that's been laid out, we should see by the middle of this century, maybe a little later, a complete return of certainly the ozone hole phenomenon and general ozone layer depletion to the sort of pre-rapid decline levels in the 1970s. So, you know, it's possible within my lifetime, I'll see it return to the way it was, which is an amazing thing.
For those of us living in the U.S. and maybe specifically for those of us living in Arizona, what does it mean that the hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica is getting small? Like, is there any particular significance other than the fact that this seems like a good thing for the Earth more broadly?
I mean, as I said, the ozone hole over the Antarctic is kind of the acute, extreme manifestation of something that does occur everywhere on the planet. We have ozone in the upper portion of the atmosphere everywhere, and it protects us from damaging ultraviolet radiation. And so the two are linked. The ozone hole is just the kind of most extreme canary in the coal mine, if you will. It's kind of the siren of the problem. And so seeing it improve does mean that there's generally improvement everywhere on the planet, and that's good for Arizonans, particularly since we live in a place with a lot of sunshine, not a lot of cloud cover, which means we, unlike a lot of other populations in the U.S., experience a lot of solar exposure. And with that solar exposure is ultraviolet radiation. And with less ozone, that means it's more damaging. So I think it's a good sign, particularly for people in the Southwest, both us and the environment that we share.
Kevin Gurney is a professor in the School of Life Sciences at ASU. We are talking about this year's measurement of the hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica, which was the smallest it's been since 1988.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.